The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on June 9, 2019. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. Good morning. Nice to see you all here this morning on this wonderful spring day. I'm going to be giving a talk today that's titled Real Charioteer. It's kind of a strange name, but hopefully why I titled it that will come clear as I give my talk. So it struck me recently again, and I don't know if it strikes you this way, I feel like we live in angry times. And the way I guess I would say we live in angry times is it seems to be times in which people are given permission to be angry or feel that they have permission to be angry and so are angry. And this came to mind recently when I was driving, and of course driving seems to be a real rich bed, like a fertile loam for anger to arise. And it was actually out on Crosstown, and I'm locating it so that those of you who've been driving on Crosstown know Crosstown has really been a place where anger can arise. And I was getting onto the Penn Avenue exit because the Xerxes Avenue exit is impossible. It is impossible. So I was taking the Penn Avenue exit, which is becoming impossible as well. And in fact, what happened was you could see as you were approaching Penn Avenue that the Penn Avenue exit was really backed up, basically to Crosstown. So what people started doing is they decided that the shoulder was now a new lane and they could drive past everybody. But what they didn't realize, of course, is that people would be turning right on Penn, so at some point the shoulder goes away. So people, and then you know what happens when you have a long line of cars of people who've been waiting through several lights to get up to that road, and then somebody zooms past them illegally, they don't want to let them in. So I saw that happen. I saw a guy drive right past me, and I went, well, he's not going to get too far. And then he struggled to merge in with the other traffic. And as I got closer to Penn, I realized there was another car, a different car, just sitting there, right at that point where there was no more shoulder. It was just sitting there. And I couldn't tell what on earth they were doing. They didn't have their hazards on. They didn't have a signal light on. There didn't seem to be any damage from an accident. So I really couldn't tell what was going on. And I thought, well, not my concern then. And then the person put their signal light on. And I'm guessing they just got stuck there. And so I was behind this person. And I thought, they're never, no one's ever going to let them in. So I'll let them in. So I let a big space open up between me and the car in front of me that you could basically merge a semi-truck into. And the person didn't take the opening. Instead, they sped up in front of the car in front of me and they wedged their car in there and they stuck their arm out the window and they flipped the person off. And I just thought, oh my goodness, you know, here we could have saved a lot of grief had they just merged into that big, nice space I was clearly letting them have. But they wanted to be angry. They were probably angry already, and they wanted that person, that other car, to know they were angry. There's something kind of pleasurable in that situation to flip that person off, you know, to really indulge that anger. Because perhaps, I don't know what happened there, but perhaps there was a situation or a moment where maybe there was like a little gap, and that person had been trying to get through, and then the car in front of me just like cut them off. Who knows? But the person clearly wanted to express their anger. And I think we all know the pleasure in expressing anger. It can be pleasurable. And it being right. And they often seem to go together. I'm angry because I know I'm in the right and you think that I'm in the wrong. And here's, you know, and then you make sure that you express that rightness and that anger. So that got me to thinking about a chapter in the Dhammapada, Chapter 17, which is titled Anger. So this is the Buddha's teaching. The Dhammapada is a collection of teachings that are purported to be the words of the Buddha. They're from the Pali Canon. They're very early teachings. So I just thought I would read to you roughly half of the chapter on anger. It's fairly short. It's I don't know, about 13 verses or something like that. I'm going to really just focus on the first five verses. So verses 221 through 226, that's what I'll be talking about today. And I'll also then jump to the last four verses right at the end of my talk, just because I think they'll really put a nice, I don't know, final words on what it is I'm talking about. So let me just read to you verses 221 through 226, and then I'll go back and kind of go over what the Buddha's talking about. And I'm hoping I've not made a talk this morning that is going to go on way too long. So here is the beginning of the chapter, anger. Give up anger, give up pride, and free yourself from worldly bondage. No sorrow can befall those who never try to possess people and things as their own. Those who hold back rising anger like a rolling chariot are real charioteers. Others merely hold the reins. Conquer anger through gentleness, unkindness through kindness, greed through generosity, and falsehood by truth. Be truthful. Do not yield to anger. Give freely even if you have but little. The gods will bless you. Injuring no one, self-controlled, the wise enter the state of peace beyond all sorrow. Those who are vigilant, who train their minds day and night and strive continually for nirvana, enter the state of peace beyond all selfish passions. And that's where I'm going to stop, and I'll talk about that section. It's interesting, when I first looked at this chapter, it was the next verse that really caught my eye, but I realize it's really going to be hard to talk about. So I'd recommend reading this chapter on your own. So let's start out at the beginning again. I want to look at the first sentence. Give up anger, give up pride, and free yourself from worldly bondage. Give up anger. I just want to look at that. Of course, we all know easier said than done. But when we hear give up anger, I want to make sure that we note that what the Buddha is not saying is no anger. So he's not saying no anger. The reason for this is if you get an idea that the teaching is no anger, and then anger arises, then you've got this interesting thing where you're teaching no anger, and reality, anger, don't seem to be aligned with one another. And this teaching is about truth. It's about how reality is showing up. It's about living reality as it's showing up. So this is not a teaching of no anger. That other thing where you say, well, okay, Buddha teaches no anger, and then anger arises, and then you go, you do that thing, I think I described this rather recently, where you are suddenly struggling with the fact that now anger is showing up, and Buddhists don't have anger. There's no anger in Buddhism, so what am I doing? This is, and that's our business as usual. Or we get ideas about the world, we create these sort of brittle rules about how life should and should not be, and then when it shows up the way it should not be, then we don't know what to do, then we have a crisis. So this is not a teaching of no anger. That is not to say that this is a teaching of, well, sometimes anger is good. Sometimes anger is useful. Like, anger allows me to see that some injustice is occurring in the world, and I'm going to get angry, and we're going to change things through that anger. So it's not saying that sometimes anger is good. That kind of sense of anger is a sense of righteous anger, that there's righteous anger. And I'll talk about that in a moment. But that sense that sometimes anger is good, when people talk about that, and they see a translation of Buddhist teachings, and they see the word anger, and that the Buddha says, give up anger. A lot of people will, well, not a lot of people, but I've heard people say what they prefer there is not anger. That what the Buddha is talking about is hatred or ill will. But hatred, ill will, and anger, though we can kind of see differences, they're all rooted in a very similar kind of feeling or emotion. One of hostility, one of something out there that you're disliking. that you hold with. Disliking is like the nice way to put it. When we're talking about hatred or ill will or anger, that's that flash, that's that, there's poison in that. One problem with that idea that sometimes anger is good, of course, is that when we hear a teaching like give up anger, the implication is, and we hear what I just said about hatred, ill will, and anger, we can see the poison in that. Oh, then this stuff is bad. But I also want to point out that the teaching is not saying anger is good or bad. That's not the teaching. It doesn't say anger is bad, it just says give up anger. Anger is dukkha. Anger is the mind unsettled. It is the mind out of kilter. It is a strong refusal of what is showing up. It is a strong refusal of that. And I just wanted to read to you something along those lines. It's from the introduction to this chapter. And I'm reading from the Dhammapada that was translated by, I was in there with YouTube trying to find somebody saying this guy's name because I really don't know how to say it. There's something like Eknath Iswaran. And he wrote a best-selling translation of the Bhagavad Gita that I also have. He's a very good writer. And he's a good scholar of Buddhist teachings as well. And he wrote this little introduction. He writes one to each of the chapters. And he says this at the beginning of the chapter on anger. The Buddha is not among those who praise righteous indignation. When he exhorts us to give up anger, he does not list under what specific conditions this should be done. It should simply be given up. And that is all. His concern is with mental states, and since an angry mind is out of control, the Buddha naturally counsels against it. Even if getting angry gives a sense of triumph or seems to ease pent-up tensions, anger is linked with dukkha, suffering. Free yourself from anger, the Buddha says, and dukkha cannot touch you. Since freedom from dukkha is the goal of his entire teaching, he puts a high priority on the conquest of anger. And we can see, you know, with something like righteous anger, which I think is where a lot of the anger that I see today, a lot of people are coming from their positions that this is the right way, I have the truth, you're speaking the non-truth, you know, and they'll speak their righteous anger, is that that becomes self-righteous very easily. So I'm reading the Oresteia, which is an ancient collection of plays. It's by Aeschylus. I don't know if you've heard of the plays. They're one of the few surviving trilogies of ancient Greek tragedy. I don't know if you know this, but all those ancient Greek plays were part of trilogies, a three-play. So sort of like the Star Wars series, except, well, they have a trilogy of trilogies, right? So it's sort of like meta Star Wars, whatever. But it's sort of like the Star Wars stories. They all had three plays. They actually had four plays, but three tragedies that came together. And most of them don't exist. Certainly not an entire trilogy. The Oresteia is the only one that does. And I'm only telling you that because there's a scene in there where I'm seeing righteous anger. It's in the first play. It's Agamemnon. And Agamemnon was a great leader, great warrior. He went and he fought the Trojan War. I'm sure you all heard of that. But in order to fight the war, I don't know if you know this part, but his people were sitting around waiting, trying to sail off to Troy, and the weather wasn't cooperating. And so Agamemnon sacrificed one of his daughters so that they could go to Troy. And this just is horrifying to think of. I mean, one doesn't have to look too hard to see that that crosses some line. And sure enough, what it does, the effects of that in the Oresteia, in the play Agamemnon, the one I'm talking about, is the Trojan War has finished, and now Agamemnon is returning. And who's waiting for him is his wife, Clytemnestra, who is going to kill him because of what he did. And she's been plotting, waiting for this moment for him to come back so she can kill him. And it's the scene after she kills Agamemnon. And again, we can understand the pain. We can understand the agony. We can understand that need for justice. But it's in how she describes why she did what she did. She tells it to the chorus, that one can just see her crossing into this. It's just, it's hubris. It's a crime against the gods. It's, you can see that what she's doing is, it's actually very self-indulgent. And so righteousness and self-righteousness, they link together quite easily. And in fact, we can see in that opening line of the Buddha, we can see that he points to that as well. Because that opening line, after he says, give up anger, he says, give up pride. So it's give up anger, give up pride, and free yourself from worldly bondage. And pride is that feeling that is all about the self. Buddhism teaches there are three kinds of pride. And I could relate to this. So there's pride where you think you're better than everyone. That's the one we're all aware of. Then there's pride where you think you're worse than everyone. And that's what I can relate to for sure. Where you, almost with your friends, you have competition about who sucks the most, right? So no, I'm worse than that. And then there's the one that I think we're actually most familiar with, which is the pride of, we're just like everyone else. Oh yeah, maybe I do that, but they do that too. Or the opposite, well, if they do that, just like, but if you look at what all of these versions of pride are about, they're about the self, and they're about defining that self, often in relation to others. Well, often, that's all it is. It's about defining the self in relation to others. That's how the self arises, is in relation to others. But pride is all about that, really cementing that sense of self, and then what is permissible and what is not permissible. So you can see then that giving up anger and giving up pride, these two come together. Anger and pride. Anger, that sense that Clytemnestra had, that she was wronged. I mean, she might put it in terms that the gods were wronged by Agamemnon's actions of killing his daughter, but you can tell when she's talking that she was wronged. This is very much rooted in that sense of self. So give up anger, give up pride, and free yourself from worldly bondage. And that worldly bondage, that's this world, the world of troubles that we're in, the world of dukkha, where we're seem to be bound by our desires, seem not to be free. And the Buddha continues, he says, no sorrow can befall those who never try to possess people and things as their own. And that's kind of an unusual line. I mean, I know what it's pointing to, but the way this translation talks about it, it's a little hard to get at. So I want to read a different translation that's perhaps a little less mellifluous than this one is, a little less lovely to the ears, but it actually helps clarify what this passage is pointing to. And this other translation is by Irving Babbitt. And he translates this line as, suffering never befalls one who clings not to mind and body and is not attached. So let me read that again. Suffering never befalls one. It's the fact that it has those double negatives in it. It's a little hard to track. So suffering never befalls one who clings not to mind and body and is not attached. So what we get, again, with this translation, no sorrow can befall those who never try to possess people and things as their own. And it's that possession that Babbitt translates as clinging and attachment. And if you look at Babbitt's translation, it's clinging to mind and body. That's clinging to a sense of self. That in this translation is trying to possess people and things as their own. So there's that strong sense of self in there. Clinging to mind and body. And then not attached. And this attachment is a teaching, I think, that is, we think of attachment, we might think of it as like even clinging is hanging on to something. But that hanging on isn't so explicit as we might think it is. It's just taking the world to be the way we think it is to cling. And the way that we often think the world is it's a world made up of things outside of me. So we have the other, and what's going to happen once we have the other? How do I relate to that? And it's back to me. The other shows up, self shows up along with it. Self shows up, there's a outside world that goes with it. At least that self, that is the self that's in relation to a world that's outside of it. So trying to possess people and things in their own, as their own, doesn't mean necessarily to try to own people, necessarily. But it is to cling to ideas we have about people and things, the way that we see them. So we try to possess people and things as our own, the way that we take them. That's what we hang on to. That is what can cause us some troubles. And we have a precept that we recite here roughly every 2 months that gets to the heart of this. So I'm going to read to you the teaching that goes along with the precept, and then I'll read to you the precept. And the precept is what we all recite. The teaching is what the preceptor or the teacher says to us before we recite the precept. And the preceptor says, self-nature is clear and obvious. Within the suchness of all-pervading Dharma, not clinging to a single form is called the precept of not being avaricious. And then the precept is, a follower of the way does not possess anything selfishly. So I think you can see now how the two translations are pointing to the same thing. So again, not clinging to a single form. And clinging to a form is just believing that that form has solidity, that it has substance, that it's something that's not impermanent and continually changing and not part of the whole, the dynamic whole. Not clinging to that single form is not being avaricious. Avaricious is greedy. It's not possessing. It's not hanging on to anything. And it's anything selfishly, out of that sense of self, which is the only way you can possess something. It's really the only way you can do it is selfishly. Because if you see what's really taking place, if you understand what the self really is, how can that self possess anything? So if we look at that whole first verse, give up anger, give up pride, and free yourself from worldly bondage. No sorrow can befall those who never try to possess people and things as their own. The Buddha's pointing to anger. He's pointing to self-delusion, that sense of self. He's pointing to, or we could call that pride, and he's pointing to greed, clinging or possessing. Those are the three poisons of mind. Those are the states of mind that arise so easily and can throw us into confusion. Well, that's what they do. They throw us into confusion. And he also talks about release from all of that. So he's talking about nirvana, all in that first verse. Then he continues and he says, those who hold back rising anger like a rolling chariot are real charioteers. Others merely hold the reins. And I really like that image that he has there of those who hold back rising anger like a rolling chariot are like real charioteers. And I want to say something about that holding back anger, because that starts to sound like we're repressing something. We're holding back the anger. It's coming up and we're tamping it down. But I think if you really look at that image, those who hold back rising anger like a rolling chariot are real charioteers. So it's like a rolling chariot. It's actually the real charioteer, they're in control of that rolling chariot. So you have the horses, the chariot is going. Are you in control, that the real charioteer is in control of whatever shows up? Anything that shows up, they can deal with it. Granted, there's probably going to be an accident every once in a while, but that's what makes the real charioteers. They can deal with the bumps that come up. You know, maybe you've known people who can drive like that. I met a guy once, and he drove like, I don't we went down that street. Is it Lombard Street, the one in San Francisco that goes back and forth and back and forth? And this friend of mine, the way that he drove down it, is he would just, it was like ballet with a steering wheel. It was just like, he wasn't making any effort at all. He was just talking to us, and he was moving his hand on the steering wheel. We were going zip, 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 zip. You know, real charioteer. Or I think about even better. I don't know how many of you are Buster Keaton fans, but there is a scene that I think is one of the greatest scenes of all cinema that is a real charioteer working right there. We could see what's taking place. He's driving a car, and the car starts falling apart. Just pieces of it just start coming off, and he just keeps driving that car, and it literally falls to pieces. Everything comes off the car. He rides it down to the ground. It is something to behold, and that's what I think of it, that holding back the anger is just not letting the anger be in control. That's all it is. So it's when that shows up, the real charioteer, the anger isn't in control. The horses aren't in control. The course or the bumpiness of the road isn't in control. The charioteer is in control. All others, they merely hold the reins. If you've ever seen a Western where like a greenhorn gets behind the reins of a stagecoach or something and then shop, those horses go on, maybe even the reins slip out of their hands and they have no control at all. So that's why I like that image. It's that real charioteer. And that real charioteer once again brings me back to a teaching that we've been talking about for probably about a month now in our Suzuki Roshi discussion group, The Boss of Everything. And I at least wanted to, I keep mentioning this in talks, and I thought, well, I might as well read to you the passage where he talks about the boss of everything, because the boss of everything is the real charioteer, and it's that self that's not that little self who just merely holds the reins. It's a different self. It's a different, we call it like big self, but it's a different self. Let me just read to you what he says. Suzuki writes, "The reason we practice Zazen," and that's our sitting meditation, that's actually really just mindfulness meditation. "The reason we practice Zazen is to be the boss of everything, wherever we are. But if I say so, it will create a misunderstanding that you are the boss of everything and everyone. When you understand in that way, you exist as an idea in your mind. That is not the you we mean. That is a delusion because," this is very important, "the ideas you have are not well supported by your practice. And you become enslaved by the idea of you and others. When the real power of practice is supporting your understanding, then the you who is practicing our way is the boss of everything, the boss of you yourself." That's that real charioteer. When we're practicing meditation, which is really to be fully awake in this moment. In this moment, it's the wrong way to put it. It's just to be fully awake. It's to be now. And that is the boss of everything. That is the real charioteer. And the Buddha continues. So, okay, now we've got this real charioteer. Anger is going to arise. Real charioteer, the horses of anger are not going to take that charioteer off. The Buddha continues, he says, "Conquer anger through gentleness, unkindness through kindness, greed through generosity, and falsehood by truth." Let me just kind of look at those passages first, because I at least want to give them, there's a way we can just understand those teachings swimming on the surface, but the Buddha's pointing, I think, at some subtle teachings here, so we can see the depths of the water. We can still swim. There's an interesting comparison that a comedian had once. I don't know if you know who Stephen Wright is, but he was a great deadpan comedian. He'd say really bizarre things like, I remember one he said was, "The other day I was thinking, no, wait a minute, that wasn't me." So he has real deadpan humor. And sometimes it takes a while to even catch up with his jokes. But somebody had asked him if he got more nervous when he was in front of a crowd of 50,000 people, because there was a point when he was a superstar, or if he was more comfortable in the small club, and he said, you know, whether you're swimming over a mile of water or just 6 feet of water, it's still swimming. But we can still sense those depths of the water, the depths of these teachings. So conquer anger through gentleness is the first teaching we have here. And again, just because Iswaran also pointed this out in his introduction, I just wanted to point out that gentleness, the word that Iswaran said he translated as gentleness was non-anger. And that's the way that Irving Babbitt translates it. He says overcome anger by non-anger. And I wanted to point that out because non-anger is just the state of non-anger. It's not being caught up in anger. It's in a way when anger shows up, it's not meeting anger with anger, which I think is something that real easily shows up. Somebody starts yelling at you and you start yelling at them because you're staking out your territory. I'm not saying this always happens, but it tends to. The energy flies out. Person catches the energy, they throw it right back. As that wise Italian, I don't remember the name of the character right now, in Jim Jarmusch's movie Down by Law pointed out, you throw a pool ball at me, I throw a pool ball at you. Right? So there's that same thing. And that's what happens with anger. It's like a pro wrestling match. So overcome anger by non-anger. Overcome anger by gentleness. By really not to give up anger. To not give anger that solidity, that reality that we want to give it, and then to just engage with it on its own terms, just to give that up. Conquer unkindness through kindness. And unkindness, of course, you know, we know unkind behavior. We've probably engaged in it ourselves from time to time. But we certainly can see it when others are doing it. And just how do you do that? If you see an unkind act, do you address it then by being unkind? And like I said, the Buddha is telling us, conquer unkindness through kindness. When it arises, when unkindness arises, be kind. But there's something else about unkind that I think is what anger is rooted in. Unkind, dissimilar, this difference, this sharp edge separation, this division. Overcome or conquer that division, that hard edge, that separation. Overcome that by recognizing that what is showing up is us, the person maybe that we think we're engaging in unkind acts with, or the unkind act we see, just see that that is us and take care of that. That beyond those separations we see, reality is actually functioning seamlessly as a whole. Conquer greed through generosity. And of course, again, there's just a nice, simple, almost folksy teaching in there that you be generous. And you yourself, if you're generous, you're not going to be greedy. And often people who hang on to something, when they see somebody letting go, it becomes easier for them to let go. I don't know how many of you saw the production, The Metamorphoses, at the Guthrie Theater. Yeah, it was a pretty wonderful production. Not Kafka's Metamorphosis, but, and I don't know, I also listened to this. I thought, how do you pronounce Ovid? Ovid's Metamorphoses. So it's a Roman poet. Collection of stories of transformations. And one of the stories in there that I thought was pretty touching was one that I think Bertolt Brecht stole, actually, when he wrote the play The Good Person of Szechuan, but he stole all the time, so I was just surprised to see the story somewhere else. But Zeus and Hermes come to Earth dressed as beggars. They just want to see how they'll be treated. What is this human animal? Let's test them out. And so they go around dressed as beggars, and they're begging alms, and they just are constantly rejected. And they finally come to the house of a poor old couple. They just have nothing. And these paupers are out there begging, and they give them, they give them a feast, the best feast they can. They give their chairs up to these two, right? They make them comfortable. They feed them. And the gods are touched. It's Zeus and his son Hermes. And they're touched by the generosity of this old couple who have nothing to give. And so they reveal that they're gods. And then what does the old couple do? They scold themselves for having given them such a lousy feast. And they gave them everything they could. And the gods are touched by that. That's the response, is that, oh, boy, what we did was terrible. We're so sorry. And so the god said, well, we'll give you whatever you want, as in a way, as a reward for your generosity. And this speaks to the character of this old couple, but it also speaks to what generosity actually is. So you're waiting for them to make the mistake at this point. Now the gods are saying, whatever you want, and often when gods do that, people make the wrong choice and then bad things happen. But this old couple just says, we would actually just like to leave life at the same time so that we don't suffer grief. That's it, a very simple, touching request. And the gods grant that. So they finish out their life and they pass away together so they don't have to experience grief. Excuse me. So you can see conquering or overcoming greed through generosity just in that kind of behavior. Just giving. Just give. Give what you have. That doesn't mean to make yourself a pauper and literally like give everything away, but what are you hanging on to something? Just give freely. But it's also non-attachment. You can see in that giving there's non-attachment. You can see in what the old couple did when they were given, when the God said, whatever you want, it's yours. There still was not that desire to possess something. So it's non-attachment. Remember, attachment, that is to possess something avariciously, to possess something greedily. It's a little hard to see how that works when that attachment is just simply the way you think about the world. But just think about how self-centered moving around the world through your understanding of how the world works, your understanding of how the world works, how self-centered that actually is. So greed through generosity is just to let go of attachment. It's non-attachment. It's to be this reality, this dynamic, seamless whole, and never taking, because you can see there's nothing to be taken. And then conquer falsehood by truth. So conquer falsehood by truth. And again, you know, on one hand, you can see lying, falsehood, that there's some problem there. We've been told as children not to lie. But the teaching here is not quite so brittle. Because if a lie arises, as I know I told you, I listened to a podcast, as he said recently, he goes, I lie every moment of the day. He goes, I lie from the moment I wake up. He goes, if people ask me a question and I think it's better to lie, I lie to them and I lie all day long. And we do that. You know, sometimes a lie is okay. So that's not this conquer falsehood by truth. Maybe we could lie a little less than we do, but that's not really what we're pointing to. It's that truth is not swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, or truth-telling. It's actually being truthful is living out this reality. That's truth. Again, any notions we have about whether we're telling a lie or telling the truth, and then what, again, that tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. I think I told you I had a professor once who was deposing for, he was on the trial for the poem Howl, if you know that, Allen Ginsberg's Howl, and it was considered to be a work of obscenity. And so they called this professor that I had on as an expert witness because he was a literary scholar who was really familiar with avant-garde poetics. So they brought him up, And when they made him to swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God, he was like, so help me God, I am going to... And so he was going to start talking about what a bad poem he thought Howell was. And he wasn't really allowed to. The lawyer he worked with was way too savvy. He asked him the yes or no question. Herb wanted to take it off, and the lawyer said, that's enough. Yeah, we got what we needed. Thank you very much, Professor Blau. So that what is the truth? That's what Herb asked after a while. He just said, what is the truth, the whole truth and nothing but... What are we talking about? Good question. So we're not talking about that. Conquering falsehood. Falsehood is just that false understanding we have of what's showing up. Conquer falsehood. Conquer that divided world, that parceled out world, that fragmented world. Conquer that with the truth of really seeing what's showing up. And so be truthful. Again, this is what I was talking about. That's being truthful is living reality and not just some fragmented idea we have of it. Or if we are living a fragmented idea of it, realizing that's what we're doing and not buying into it, not hanging on to that fragmented view, but just understanding that that's a provisional way to get through the world, and you can give that up. You don't have to hang on to it. If it gets challenged and there's no reason to defend it, don't defend it. Just kind of give that up. Be open with it. So be truthful. Give freely. That's giving freely. Reality gives freely. Reality is munificent. It just endlessly gives. So to be reality is just to really just give. But Buddha says, give freely even if you have but little. And if you really realize, you'll realize you have really nothing to speak of. So giving as if you have but little, that's where we are. So understand that. I think it is easier. Honestly, it almost makes no sense to give if you don't have so much. It's when people have a lot of stuff, they start weighing out like, well, do I get rid of this? Do I get rid of that? If I get rid of that, then you know, who else has claim to this thing that I am going to give away? And then how do I appease them, et cetera, et cetera. So when you have very little, you don't have those kinds of things weighing you down. And the Buddha continues, he says, injuring no one, self-controlled, the wise enter the state of peace beyond all sorrows. Injuring no one, and that's practicing non-injury. Because really, again, if we're conquering falsehood, if we're not living out of a fragmented, delusional way of seeing the world, then injuring somebody just doesn't even arise. It's not going to show up. Injuring no one, self-controlled, and self-controlled is like the horses from before. So it's not to exert our will upon something. It's to act from the source of everything, the boss of everything, the real charioteer. And finally, I just want to get to this last verse, 226. Those who are vigilant, who train their minds day and night and strive continually for nirvana, enter the state of peace beyond all selfish passions. And I want to read to you Babbitt's translation here, not because it's that much different, but where we have who train their minds day and night, strive continually for nirvana, sounds like when we're taking up, say, a meditation practice, a sitting meditation practice, that we're practicing, that we're training ourselves, that what we're doing is we're creating, I don't know, a particular state of mind that then when the world comes at us, when the horses start to seem to take charge or the courseway gets to be too bumpy, that we've been training for this moment. And that's not a real accurate depiction of what our practice actually is. So I wanted to read to you what Babbitt said about that. He says, those who are ever vigilant, who discipline themselves day and night. And that comes a little closer. This discipline, who are, as this translation says, who strive continually for nirvana. That's in each moment. It's the discipline of being awake in each moment, being awake, not being carried off by our delusions, not being carried off by our ideas, but being awake in each moment, vowing. That vow is really just coming back here. It's the vow is to be this, to be this. And that's that discipline is coming back. We normally very easily just go off on tangents. If you sit in a meditation hall and you sit in meditation, you know how fast your mind can get caught up in something, how you can get lost in thought. You can sit, we sit facing the wall. I don't know how far away we are from the wall. It's not very far. And yet when I'm lost in thought, I don't see the wall. And it's right there in front of me. And I tell people, you know, when I'm teaching meditation instruction, you have the opportunity to point this out and point this out to you. We do that off the cushion. We're walking around in the world and we've got this stuff going on and we don't really see what's showing up. We see it. We can't help but really see it. But we don't see it. We're sitting in front of the wall. You see the wall, but it's as if you're not seeing the wall. And so discipline is just not giving the mind free rein. It's not letting the horses take charge. But at the same time, it's letting the horses pull on the reins. This is being with that, letting it show up but not being carried away by it, not being bowled over by it. And in doing that, then, that's nirvana, is being released from our desire to control the situation. And in trying to control the situation, losing control because we've separated ourselves. But it's actually control the situation just by being with what's showing up. And I can't tell you what to do at that point because the scenery, the particular things that we do in our lives, that's going to be different from time to time. But being with it and just fully engaging in whatever it is we're if we have to choose something to do, what we're choosing to do at that moment, just being with that is to be free. Free from, again, our ideas of how it should be and maybe how it shouldn't be, and then getting tossed away by that. And that's, again, where anger shows up. It's supposed to be like this. It's not supposed to be like that. I wanted to read to you two more things, actually. So thinking about that anger and that sense of the world being the way it is. And I think I'd mentioned earlier, I probably should have brought this up earlier in my talk, but thinking about people who talk about anger as an energy that you can use to transform the world. I think I've heard people talk about that. And I just wanted to read to you a passage, just a quote that Gandhi said, that's in this book as well, about anger and transforming the world. And I'll read Iswaran's introduction too. He says, Mahatma Gandhi offers his own example of how the energy dissipated in anger can be conserved and harnessed for a selfless goal. Gandhi says, I have learned through bitter experience the one supreme lesson to conserve my anger. And as heat conserved is transmuted into energy, even so our anger controlled can be transmuted into a power which can move the world. So it's to see the energy that anger feeds from. It's really to express that energy and not the angry energy. The angry energy is the one that's rooted in self, that's rooted in dukkha. But it actually arises from the energy that's just this dynamic, seamless reality. That's dynamic stillness. When you sit, you touch, you can taste. So I wanted to then share to you these last four verses because the Buddha talks about this practice and touching this energy and practicing non-anger. The Buddha writes, use your body for doing good, not for harm. Train it to follow the Dharma, and that's truth. Use your tongue for doing good, not for harm. Train it to speak kindly. Use your mind for doing good, not for harm. Train your mind in love. The wise are disciplined in body, speech, and mind. They are well controlled indeed. If any of you have questions or comments now, I would be welcome to hear them. Yeah, David.
You kind of got to it very well in the last few little work bits of your talk, but at first I was thinking that the charioteer, the good charioteer, kept the chariot from moving at all. And it's obvious that the chariot is going, just not out of control. Is that accurate?
Right. That's absolutely right. So that's what I was saying when he was saying about holding back. That's the line. Holding back rising anger like a rolling charioteer isn't to repress anything. So it's not to stop that chariot. You're right, because it's a rolling chariot. That's absolutely right. So it's to not indulge that. It's not to meet the anger with anger. It's to conquer anger with non-anger. It's to not get caught up in that fragmented, fractured way of seeing that anger arises from. But yeah, you're right. It's to, again, our practice is to be with what's showing up. So if anger is arising, that's what's showing up. And this teaching offers us some pointers about how you don't get caught up in, how the horses don't carry the chariot away and tip it over, but rather how we can just be with the anger that's showing up. And actually, if you look at what the Buddha's teaching here, in this practice is in a way creating conditions in which feelings of anger are less likely to arise. So in a way, we're reducing anger, the appearance of anger as well, just in the practice that he's talking about.
That's not to say that anger does not arise.
That is right.
Okay. Yeah. I think sometimes that's very easily confused, that this practice holds up some sort of armor against negative emotions, and I don't think that's true.
Well, again, it's negative emotion. To me introduces then some valuation. So anger is just dukkha. We'll label it as negative and then think we got to get rid of those states of mind. But we can see that anger is dukkha, and that in taking up this practice, right? So if I look at the last section, use your body for doing good, not for harm. Use your tongue for doing good, not for harm. Use your mind for doing good, not for harm. So mind, body, and speech. So doing that, you'd say for good and not for harm, but out of the whole, wholesome, speaking wholesomely, acting wholesomely, thinking wholesomely. That in doing so, the conditions by which anger arises, which again is a fragmented world that sees there's a world out there and there's me here and this isn't right and this is how I'm going to respond to it, that those conditions, when you're acting, speaking, thinking from the whole, those conditions don't so readily show up. Actually, if you're actually taking that up, they don't show up. So it is to reduce anger. But yeah, no, it doesn't give you a magic armor. Anger arises, so what do? Do you get caught up and carried away by it? Or what do? Do you greet, conquer, try to conquer anger with anger, or conquer anger with non-anger? So you're right. Yeah, it's not about these states not arising. That would be no anger. And that's not the teaching. Yeah, Mike.
Yeah. In fact, the only time you can practice not giving way to anger is when you're angry.
There you go.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not like, you know, yeah. You can only be patient when you're impatient.
Yeah.
Yeah, the two of them kind of go together.
Yeah.
And also there's a similar relationship between anger and fear, and that both of them come out of a sense of self and separating out
yeah.
from the world.
Yeah, thanks for sharing. Right. So absolutely, when you're angry, there's your opportunity to practice non-anger. It just when it shows up there. That's where the rubber hits the road, so to speak. Yeah.
And as far as, you know, you mentioned making an opening for the guy on the exit to a pin, that regardless of whether the person takes it, that is making things safer for everyone. You know, when you instead of giving way to anger, try to I'm having trouble with the word, but with not giving way with anger at another driver, but when you just try to make things safer, like making an opening or slowing down so that the person that cuts you off has plenty of room, while you shouldn't have pride about it, it still is making things safer for everyone.
Yeah. Right.
Including the other person.
Calm the situation down, right? Yeah, so I certainly don't want to take pride for opening that spot up, because this morning I was merging in across town and I could see a car coming behind me and I went, they got the other lane. So I just was merging on and they weren't taking the other lane and they almost hit me. And I could have easily just slowed down. I just thought, they can just move over, right? So it's not that I'm the guy that's always going to make room. But it just at that moment I did, and that person opted to be angry instead. And in a driving situation, you can really see the potential danger for that, because the kind of action her car took, because she was so mad and because of what she was doing, the car lurched forward. I mean, there was like a out of controlness in a way to the actions that we have when we're angry. And you could just see it in the way that person was merging into traffic, that it was angry.
Well, yeah, just a bubble. A couple of years ago, there was an incident on the edge of downtown by the Walker. I don't know, you may have read about it. They had road construction on Hennepin Avenue there, so, you know, traffic was backed up, and this young woman got into it with a car full of guys, and she flipped them off, you know, and then they pulled up alongside her and shot her. Yeah. And she didn't. I think she survived, you know. She had non-life-threatening injuries, but that's the other thing that I always think.
That's what I'm saying. You can see, like, these situations are the ones you can really clearly see the danger in anger. I mean, often it's a much seemingly much less volatile or dangerous situation where we're at home and we yell at somebody. But it's the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, and there's still danger. The danger just being that continued confusion, that spreading out of confusion and then people acting out of confusion. That's the risk, the danger. So we are a little over 11 o'clock, so I'll wrap this up. If you want to speak with me or have any questions after the talk, I will be downstairs for a few minutes before the board meeting. So thank you all.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.